Hey everybody, Barry Friedman, continuing our series of interviews about the show of show business. And today, boy, man, an old friend. We'll have to figure out maybe during this when we first connected, but it's got to be in the hundreds of years ago area. We're going to talk about comedy today. You know, one of the big pieces that's gotten a lot of us to move forward in our careers and not just have our act without comedy is comedy making people laugh. I remember being a juggler earlier in the day, and my grandfather was the only one that actually wanted to see the juggling tricks. I always felt like everyone else wanted to kind of laugh and have a good time. So along that way, I went to a friend who's been performing, I don't know, definitely more than 3 decades, because he was going when I got started and I was well over that, and always had a real good knack for customizing comedy, for writing it, using formulas, understanding what made jokes funny. And he's taught it at different conventions and conferences and workshops around the world. And I feel lucky that we get to talk to him today. So as soon as he talks, he's going to be live. Scotty Meltzer.
Hey, Barry. Good to talk to you this morning. Way too early for anyone who's actually working in show business.
I know. See, yeah, but I'm up at 5:15 swimming or biking. So I had to quit. I had to quit show biz. Yeah.
You decided to be healthy.
Yeah, I know. Exactly. Now you're healthy. You've lived a healthy life, right?
I'm doing okay.
Yeah. I mean, you're not the showbiz guy we think about, you know,
I've never been that guy.
It's not like it would have been noon if it wasn't this.
although today actually it would have been 9 because I got another call coming up. So
that's awesome. Okay. Well, good. Hey, so do a little bit of just background when you started performing, you know, and certainly mention American Dream Comedy Team, my favorite.
Oh, yeah. American Dream Comedy Team, American Dream Juggling Team, American Dream Vaudeville Team. We had business cards that said all those things as we tried to find what to do.
Was that market testing?
Yeah, exactly.
That's awesome.
I started juggling late for somebody who's a pro. I started juggling like when I was 17 in college, picked it up, and then started performing with John Park as the American Dream Juggling Team back then. A year later, doing streets, doing Pier 39, doing shows like on campus. We were going to college together, so that's when we did it. Before that, I had a weird background in amateur stuff. I was in children's theater. So I was like a singer-dancer kid from the time I was like 9 or 10 or something like that. So I loved stage. I knew I wanted to do it. I was terrible. I mean, I was a terrible singer. I was a bad actor. And as a dancer, I was a boy, which was all you had to be back then.
Right. Oh, yeah. It's huge.
To get booked. So what I learned from that is I learned a lot of the lessons of sort of, you know, you give your best no matter what. You smile whether you hate it or not. You do the shows whether you're sick or not. But the actual performing that I learned as a kid, I had to kind of unlearn because I learned this sort of,
yeah,
smile and big sparkle and really fake jokes kind of things. Like one of the first jokes I ever wrote is an exaggeration, but sort of did for John and I in that first act was describing some trick. And I would say, amazing, you say. No, amazing, you say. And thinking, oh, this is going to kill.
So because of musical theater, it would have.
Oh, man, yeah. It was absolutely what you do as an 11-year-old on stage as the Cowardly Lion. I mean, that's exactly what you do.
The Cowardly Lion.
Start performing with John Park. We were like street performers, and we were doing it to sort of just make extra money in college. And by the time I graduated, it was my full-time job. Wow. So I never had that sort of step that people who do it as an adult, especially like stand-ups do, where you go, do I need to quit my day job? Am I making enough? It's like, no, I was in college, so I didn't need to make that much. And by the time I graduated, we were booked. So yeah. Like, well, what are we going to do now? Same thing we did yesterday. We're going to do the gig that we're booked for. And I also was lucky enough not to get successful earlier to where I would have quit college going, well, let me quit college and do this. So really the point at which John and I said, we're making our living. This is, you know, we're fine with this. Mm. Was probably maybe 3 or 4 months before we graduated. And so we said, well, let's at least finish school. Okay. I mean, we've only got 3 months to go, so we'll get the degrees. And it was the same year we were graduating. So there was none of that weirdness. So I got a couple of degrees that it turns out I sort of use on my resume now.
Right.
Worked with John for like 11 years. We started as street performers.
We did
some Vegas stuff. We did a lot of fairs. Fairs was sort of our main market. And then towards the end, he and I started doing two kinds of corporate, the corporate you and Dan did.
The other guy, yeah.
Yeah, the after dinner kind of corporate stuff. And we started doing trade shows. We just started doing that. Then I worked with John, moved to Toronto, I think, to get away from me.
Right.
Actually moved to Michigan first.
Michigan, right.
Yeah. And I started working with Rich Ross. We did like 11 years together. Some fairs, mostly trade shows.
What name was that under?
That was Monkey Wrench, the Comedy Monkey Explosion. Wrench.
Yep, that was yeah. great.
And then in sort of the last, and we got along really well. We had a lot of fun. The last maybe 6 months to a year was miserable. We were
bumping heads a lot
to the point where like at the end, it was like, we can't do another show. We just cannot do another show together. At that point, it's like, okay, do I, you know, what am I going to do? Am I going to go solo? Am I going to get another partner? And that was when I formed Comedy Industries, which was much more a company than an act.
Right.
So I would do solo and I would do shows with various people. I did, you know, Tim Kelly and I started working together. Sarah Felder and I worked together.
We got to do one.
You and I did a great one. That was really fun where you said one of the smartest things ever.
That was so fun.
When you said, all right, given that you've already paid us for this.
did I say that to a guy?
It was great. It was great. I think what happened was they like booked us for two pieces of the thing and like the second piece fell apart.
Oh, I remember that. Right.
And rather than giving them some sort of discount in the middle of the day, you said, well, given that you've already paid us for this, here's what we can do. And I just went, this guy's smart.
That's so funny. I remember that.
Yeah.
You've already paid us. Let's not talk about backpedaling here.
Right, exactly. Given you've already paid us for this, why don't we'll go out, gather, you know, we'll do just a thing, we'll sort of gather a crowd for your people so you can do the awards ceremony outside. And I was just going, ooh, I like this guy.
That was fun. You know, that was actually the very first time, and this is a great lead into the comedy. That was the very first time in my life I probably ever memorized like an actual comedy script.
Like a real script like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Having working with Dan, you know, for 100 and whatever years, you know, we just boom, 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 boom. You know how it is when you work with someone. Yeah. But man, that was amazing. Yeah. I couldn't believe it was fun for one thing. And it was like this anticipation of, oh, this would be a great joke. And then it was. It was really interesting to have a script.
And one of the things, by the way, one of the jokes or one of the ways that you acted, one of those jokes stayed in the show.
Oh, cool.
So everybody else does it now, which was one of the things that sort of taught me was I was working with a lot of people. I'd work with one person for one show and somebody else for another or solo for this. And each person would like have their own take or add their own joke or something like that. And I'd go, oh, that's great. And we would build it up that way.
That's it.
And then eventually, after, I don't know, I'm going to say 5 years of sort of that kind of thing. And Katrina Spang Hansen, formerly of Grin and Bear It, she was one of the people I worked with. Then, you know, she and I sort of became the company. So now she and I are partners. We're partners in Comedy Industries. We do an act together called Scotty and Trink because we're terrible at branding. So we decided we should have two names.
Right.
But she and I sort of are now Comedy Industries. And then when we get extra gigs, we still, you know, call other people in. So we still work with Tim. We work with Mike Godot. Rich doesn't do it anymore, although we sometimes call him. And then we got a bunch of other people who, like, if we're already booked or if they want something specifically different than the kind of thing we do, we bring in.
So we're still
that production company thing.
Yeah, I don't even think I didn't even really know the growth of that. It's great to hear. Yeah. But you know, what's always been there is, you know, Monkey Wrench, American Dream, Comedy Industries. It's been comedy and customization and
always.
Yeah, and that's always been a big piece of it. So where does the history go back in comedy to you? Probably not what you studied and got your degree in.
No. My degree's in math and computer science.
Ah, just like comedy.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the way I approach it, it is.
It is. Very formulaic.
Yeah, very much so.
Yep.
You know, being a comedy juggler, I mean, I was never a good juggler. And although I love juggling as a hobby and stuff, I was never going to be good. And that part of it wasn't what really fascinated me, although I loved juggling, but the idea of being good did not fascinate me. So I was, you know, we did a bad sort of street comedy act based, you know, on just a bunch of jokes that Frank Miles had written as Fly By Night, which I get to say I didn't steal, because I inherited John Park from Fly By.
Right. There was always that lineage that we looked for in, they came with that. Yeah.
Yeah. So I've always been a very, very strong advocate of don't steal, don't steal, don't steal. But I have to be honest that the time that, you know, a lot of people steal a lot of material when they start. Some people keep doing it, but it's common to sort of pick what you think is sort of public domain because you don't realize it isn't when you start out.
Yep.
And my moral position from that is kind of easy because when I started and didn't have an act in anything like this, here I am. I get John Park, who had, you know, who had been doing it since he was 12 or 13 or 14, something like that, had an act that he was, you know, it was like this was his act, and he and I started putting together our act from that.
Yeah.
So instead of starting with, okay, what is the generic or public domain or stolen stuff that people start with, I got to start with the dregs of what was left over from the Fly By Night act.
Was that comedy parsed out to the members, or
not like you get this joke, you get this joke. Just like everybody, it's like this was
everyone
our act
was doing.
Which I think is pretty common when people break up. I mean, I don't know very many acts who, you know, break up and say, okay, well, this bit's mine, this bit's yours, this joke is mine. Because I mean, if you've been doing a joke together for 10 or 15 years, you both go, it's mine.
Yep.
And you're probably right.
Yep.
Yeah. And then over time, you know, we started coming up with our own stuff, you know, just in a sort of haphazard way that everybody does. You know, you try it in a show, it works, you keep it in, it doesn't, you don't.
Yep.
I learned some structure and some ideas, you know, from Greg Dean when he started teaching, although I never formally took his class. I still hung out with him constantly and talked with him on the phone, and
right.
as he was developing his ideas, I was sort of a sounding board. So he and I did that together. Frank Olivier and I were trying to sort of figure out what's funny together a little bit. Frank Miles definitely had a bunch of ideas that we were learning from. Although early on, Frank Miles is, I think back then he was Frank Militello.
Yes, I was just going to say.
Back before then. And I mean, I remember him saying at one point, saying, are there any jokes other than saying you're going to do something and then not doing it?
Right. Yeah. That, wow. What a framework.
Yeah. I'm going to juggle these three torches on top of this unicycle, and then the unicycle's on the ground and you stand on top of the unicycle.
Right.
Like that style of joke. And he's going, are there any others? We go, there probably are. Let's find out.
But that template served well.
That was a start of a lot of them. The real customization started when we were doing the sort of regular corporate stuff where you go and you write a few jokes just for the company, you know, that sort of in jokes.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if somebody told me this or we just found it out, but that idea of how much a bigger laugh you get from in jokes, how much more they like them, and how easy they are to write. In jokes are like the easiest jokes in the world.
They're free money, right?
Exactly, exactly.
And then the topper was always, oh man, that joke died last week when we did it for Intel. You know, whatever their competitor
is. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you get the free topper with that as well. It's great.
All right. Well, we had, you know, back then we sort of had the list of who is your, you know, who's your competitor,
right.
All those things, and we had some, you know, we had some jokes that we could just sort of plug in the names for.
Yep.
And others you just sort of talk to them and find out. When we started doing trade shows where we were writing a full custom script every time.
Yeah.
I think that's probably where I really started to learn, or at least practice it enough, you know, to learn to be the comedy writer I am today, I think.
Mm. Well, there's elements, there's common denominators that repeated. So you got to use those as the, those are the fulcrums of the joke, you know, we'll set up and, hey, so will you talk a little bit about, you know, something you feel good about sharing? I mean, where do you see acts making mistakes in writing jokes? And where do you see, you know, what are some simple corrections, maybe a formula that you would be willing to share?
Well, I would say the biggest mistake that you see is people not writing their own jokes.
Yeah.
If it is much easier, and again, this is usually when you start. Some people, you know, keep doing it forever. But when you start, it is so much easier to just take a joke that you've seen work and do it.
Yeah.
And if you do that, you get this little short-term burst. It's like you get a laugh in your show now that you wouldn't have had. But that moment, you've now lost the opportunity in that moment to write something for yourself. Mm-hmm. And that hole in your show that you need to fill is a gift. And learning to write jokes is going to be the biggest payoff over time for you. More than learning a new trick. All of, you know, as I said, I'm not the best juggler under any circumstances. I'm not the funniest comedian. You know, I'm not the best performer. And I'm not the best comedy writer either. But in the little niche that I found, you know, the sort of combination of memorizing, writing, performing, juggling,
yep,
crowd gathering, and being able to actually learn about their products. Like right in that Venn diagram, right there in the center.
Yep, me. That's you. Yeah,
that's, and that's
you.
Perfect, you know.
Great, yeah. You know,
if you can't be the best at something, keep getting smaller until you are.
Yeah, and you're bringing in a whole lot of elements. You know, yeah, you really are. It's wonderful. So I've gotten to see you do this a number of times and do it with you. And yeah,
it's great fun.
Yeah, it's a bit of a symphony.
Right. Oh, before I answer your next question or continue on this, I have to remember the other brilliant thing that I remember you saying, which was when you were doing a show with John Park for one of my clients. It wasn't through me, but it was for some production company that had stiffed us.
Oh, so
they never sent you they were supposed to send you a deposit and they didn't.
Right.
And it's the day of the show, and you were the one who's just said, you have to give us money or we're not going on, because we had told you, we said, these guys stiffed us, we're not getting any money from them.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So they gave, and John Park was like panic going, you can't do that. Just, I mean, they said they were going to pay us. And he said, no. And they gave you a check, and John was like, all right, we're fine. And you said, let's call the bank.
Oh yeah.
The bank says the check is rubber. There's no money there. And you said, we need cash or a cashier's check or we're not going on. And John is like, you can't do that. And the guy is like, the producer was like, I can't believe you're so unprofessional. And the line, I don't know if you actually said this, but this is my memory of it, where you said, I think there's only one person in this conversation who's allowed to be mad, and I don't think it's you.
That's right. Yeah. And I remember being indignant that John was afraid of offending a guy who just
gave you a rubber check.
Right. That game's over. Oh, yeah. My gosh.
Yeah.
Yeah. So clearly it's funny. You're saying you're not the best juggler, former comic, all these things, but you found that center of the Venn diagram. And I was certainly never that, but man, was my mind always tuned to integrity, being connected, I'm not going to compromise myself to, appease someone who's already compromised. Oh
yeah. Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Very fun.
So the other thing I would say is, so that idea of something that you've written that's not good is going to help you in the long run more than something that somebody else wrote that is.
That's good, but wasn't yours. And at some point, there's this time bomb that I have to stop doing this.
And that opportunity to learn. And learning earlier in your career is going to help when the stakes are lower.
Yeah.
There comes a time when, you've made it a little too far to be bad. So going back and trying all those things that you should have done when you were younger, it's too late. I even remember Penn Jillette going to see some magician we did not think was very good, which would be pretty much any other magician.
Yeah.
It was, I don't remember if the guy asked for advice or if they were sort of talking about it, the people he went with in the car on the way home. And it's like, it's too late. We can't help him. He's gone too far. It's too late for him to get, good.
I see.
Later when you're doing your own stuff, there's any number of things you can do right. There's even more things you can do wrong. I would say the biggest problem that people would make probably is being locked into the script they did yesterday.
Yeah. Wow. That's huge.
Because even if it's working, it only improves if you change it. So one of my little mantras was different isn't always better, but better is always different.
Mm. Nice.
So, trying things, experimenting, going, I've done the joke this way. Well, let me just try it this way. You think it'll work better? Don't know. Let's find out.
Yeah, we'll know in a few minutes.
Right, exactly. And no show is going to be destroyed by losing one or two jokes, by changing one or two things. And you only improve by changing. So once the script gets locked in, it doesn't get better.
Yeah, that's really interesting. What this brings to mind is times when we go back for clients and, say, oh yeah, we can bring a different show for you. All this, there's all this B material in the show. And it was so incredible how having an anchor joke, having something to build it around, that they're not going to remember the details of the joke, but there's a new stunt. So the comedy's big, man. It can be the base of whatever physical skill you're doing. So,
yeah. And on that idea of being willing to change, that's hard for me. I'm very much, I like to hold on. I'm very much into the precision of a joke. So changing them is sometimes scary for me.
Yeah.
And one of the things that's forced me to do it was the thing exactly you brought up, was going back to the same client the next year and the year after that. We have clients that we've worked for 15 years in a row.
Yeah.
We ran out of B material long ago.
You've seen their swag go from CD-ROMs all the way up.
Yeah. 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 So, I mean, one of the things that forced us to do new material was just that, well, we performed for them before.
Yeah.
And so, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. So that's how we learned it. In terms of some specific things about writing jokes, first of all, there are resources out there. Greg Dean has a great set of workbooks called Step by Step to Stand Up Comedy.
Yep.
Totally worth doing.
With the lime green cover. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And now there's five books where he took the book he wrote and he repackaged it in the Barry Friedman way as five workbooks so he can sell five of them. And the only difference between the book and the workbooks are the blank pages where you fill in the exercises.
No.
Yes. And by the way,
I like to disassociate myself from that system right here.
But I want to say though that I would actually recommend buying the workbooks rather than buying the original book just for those blank pages to make you do the exercises.
Make you do them. Yeah. Fill this
so
book.
You don't read through and go, oh yeah, I'll do that.
Yeah. And this is a great step in comedy. Quitting too soon, quitting before you've really shined the nugget.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you're saying those pages will make you keep working, keep rewriting, get rid of a syllable. I mean, my gosh, the small element that can make a joke from eh to, you know, show ending is sometimes a syllable, a word.
Oh, yeah. We had a joke where we were speaking Spanish badly. And I would say, ¿por qué? And Rich was translating the joke, was the idea. Yeah, so I was speaking Spanish and he was translating. And I would say, ¿por qué? And he would say, butter. And it was cute.
Yeah.
You know, parquet butter. It was cute.
Back from the old days, right?
Yeah. When we changed it, he added one word. I said, parquet. And he said, with butter, which made the joke have a little sexual tinge, you know, little double entendre from the setup before it. And it actually became a rock solid joke in the show.
Wow.
So much so that I just realized it's still there, even though no one has heard of parquet as butter in
decades.
I probably should take that joke out.
But that's a good point too. When do we remove a joke?
Yeah, I mean, you saw people who would do jokes about the Vietnam War, and they kept doing them, you know, 10 years later, 20 years later, and then finally repurposed them when there was a new war and it became the Iraqi helicopter instead of that, and are still doing them.
Wow. Yeah.
Topical jokes really have a shelf life, and there's a weird thing about this, which is, very often the audience won't tell you this. But what I mean by that is they'll still laugh, but they'll laugh and they'll have a thing in their mind that says, wow, this shit is dated. This guy, you know, this is old.
Because he'll never
still laughing.
Yeah, because he'll never see this. Dennis Miller was that guy. He had his Vegas act and we opened for him for years and it never changed. But, you know, he talked about Tonya Harding 10 years after Tonya. But the only thing he would add to the thing, remember this knucklehead, you know, so it would be remember this, you know, but man, I heard from people after the show, they're like, where did that material come from? You know, I see him on TV and he's killing. Dennis was like, yep, I have my Vegas act. I never change it.
Right. And those lines probably were still getting a laugh.
They were getting a laugh, but what's happening is what you were talking about.
Yeah, there's a taste, a weird taste to it.
Yep. Yeah.
Now, the exception, of course, for that would be Gilbert Gottfried, who all his references or to the Al Jolson era. I mean,
everything
specifically, you know, it becomes a meta joke for him.
Yeah.
To answer the question of sort of specific methods. So there are books out there. There are lots of books on writing comedy, and especially, you know, there are books about writing stand-up comedy for late night shows and things like that. They're great to read. They're, you know, according to Greg, there is sort of one structure that all jokes come from. Mm. Which is an interesting sort of universal thing. You know, it's that joke diagram thing that he does.
Yep.
But I actually think it's more useful, whether it's true or not, instead of to think of there's one universal structure for jokes and here is a method for writing them, thinking that there are as many ways to write jokes as there are jokes. Mm. I don't know that it's more true. I think it's more useful. So you see these methods when you read books, like, you know, the old two-list method, which I always credited to Jean Perret.
Yeah, Jean Perret.
But probably predates him.
Probably, yeah.
And, you know, these named methods, but instead of thinking, oh, this is how you write a joke, because if you do, the way you learn it, you'll probably write the same kind of joke all the time, is this is one tool. And so you get as many of these as you can.
Yeah, you can see that in certain comedians. You know, every joke is the same.
Same kind of format, same kind of structure. The thing that I've been thinking about lately, and I've taught, you know, taught workshops and taught classes in comedy, although it's never, you know, being a teacher has never been my thing. Mm-hmm. Just sort of, it just happens. Is now to think of this idea of saying, I can't teach you to write a joke. I can teach you how to learn to write a joke. And so here is,
right.
Yeah. And so here is close to what I did, you know, along with getting ideas from other people and reading, that I think is super useful. And I think that this is useful at any time in your career. I think this is useful when you're starting out. And I think this is useful after you're successful and working professionally, either as a comedian or a comedy writer for other people, because it'll expand your toolbox. And that is, watch some shows that you think are funny, you know, things that you like and you think are funny, and write down a bunch of the jokes. Not, you don't have to write up every word of it, you know, the shorthand, what it is.
Right.
And then look at it and say, what is it that I'm laughing at? What do I think is funny?
What happens here?
And you get 20 jokes or 100 jokes written down like this from 5-10 different people. 10 jokes from 10 people, let's just say, 100 jokes. You'll start to see things that are the same in all of them. Those things that somebody's going to teach you, like, wow, surprise is a really important thing in a joke. Pushing boundaries is a really important thing in a joke. Double meaning is an important thing in a joke. You'll see these things in common, and you'll start to develop your own ideas about it, but you'll also see some unique things. And so for each one of those, so for each of those different jokes, you can come up with a method. How would I write that joke? Now, this is very close to the idea of switching someone else's joke. So you see a joke you like and you write a switch on it, so you make it your own.
Yep.
And there are some specific methods for doing that. That's usually one that I teach. We call it switching to the bone. But
do you like to switch to the point? I mean, can you switch to the point that the original person wouldn't recognize it?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
That's a test. Right.
Yeah, so a real shorthand of this method. This is something I would teach in the classes. You just choose a joke that you like, something that gets a laugh. You write down, you say, what do I think is funny about this? And that decision right there is a creative act. Not everyone will get the same answer. Gotcha. So people will say different things are funny about different joke, about the same joke. Then you say, okay, what's another way I can do that thing? You erase the original joke.
Yep.
How can I do that? And the question there is not what's a funny way I can do this, it's what's another way I can do the structure I've just said.
Gotcha.
You fill a page with those, it'll turn out some of them will be funny. Both because the original structure is valid if you were right. You
know, yep.
That is the thing you're laughing at. And also because comedy is a numbers game. I will jump back and give another piece of advice to everybody, which is most of the stuff you write will not be good.
Yep.
Most of the jokes you write will not be funny. And the better you are as a comedian and a comedy writer, I don't even know that the percentage that you write of jokes that are funny goes up. It probably does. But more important, what goes up is their speed with which you can write a bunch of them. And different comedy writers and performers have a different style when they're working. Some will, you know, spew out every possible joke. They're not embarrassed by the dreck. They'll suggest them if they're working with somebody else, they'll write them down. Others will sort of do that in their head and only write down or only pitch the good ones. But for almost everybody I've talked to, it's a numbers game.
Yeah, numbers game. I agree. Yeah.
Yeah.
But Jerry Seinfeld had mentioned something in an interview about the amount of time he writes every day and how little of it makes it on stage. So, I mean, at that level, which we can agree is probably the gold standard.
Still
playing the numbers game.
It's totally a numbers game.
Yeah.
And it's this numbers game that has this wonderful thing where you can immediately find out whether you're right, because the audience will tell you.
Yeah, so quickly.
Yeah.
So, I remember working the Renaissance festivals back in the early 80s. I would see acts do a joke that didn't get a laugh, and I'd see them the next show, and they'd do the joke again. I'm like, what the hell has changed?
You know,
Why would it work with this group of drunk people, but it didn't with this group? And Dan and I beat those fares to death with, oh, let's try this joke, throw in this one. And then,
yeah.
I mean, I hated doing a joke that I knew was about to die.
Yeah. Now, I want to back you up for a question on that, which was, you were seeing people who would do the same joke over and again and have it not work at all each time, right?
Yeah, and just right. Do it again.
Yeah, then there's that fascinating thing where you do it, it doesn't work, and then the next show it does, and you can't figure out what's different about it.
God, yeah, it's
the other changes. There's
it's something so subtle. Sometimes it's not, we can't say it's the same because it's not a written scientific test. Yeah, yeah. Inflection, timing, something sure. Someone just yelled in the audience.
Yeah.
There's a lot of variables.
Yeah. And you, as you get better, I think you start to internalize an audience. You start to know what they laugh at. So you can, when you're writing a joke, you can be better at guessing whether it's going to work, but you're still not always right.
Group of 600 salespeople in Las Vegas. Like, I have a really good idea of what they're going to laugh at. There's common denominator all over the place that you have to tag into. Right.
And then sometimes you're wrong. And then sometimes the line that you thought was the setup is where you get the laugh.
Yes.
There's a joke that I still have not been able to make work for an audience. And it's with Katrina, and you know, it's a juggling joke. So we could do it with passing seven. So that would be, there are any number of tricks you could do it with, but you know, passing seven. And for this, I'm going to be purposefully throwing badly because that's what I do. And so she says, how are my throws? And I say, perfect and beautiful, just like you. And she says, yours are short and too fast. Now, I love that joke.
Mm-hmm.
Audience does not agree.
Yeah.
You know, and I thought it was clever. I thought it was funny. I thought it was a nice double entendre. I thought it fit our characters. Audience does not agree.
Right. Over and over.
Yeah. Over and over. And I tried it many, many times in many, many different places.
It's a syllable away, man.
Yeah, exactly. There's going to be a way. I'm going to make this one work. So, yeah, there is that thing of being locked in, you know, you have an excuse for being locked into a joke that works. And even then you should change it to make it better. You know, you should be playing with it.
Yep.
Except on, you know, maybe on the most important show or your audition, do the version.
Yeah. Go with what works. Yeah.
And still change things, you know, but the ones that aren't working, I mean, if it's not working, the next thing you do is not going to be worse. It's just not going to work also.
Right.
So, you know, try a bunch. And if you don't, you know, if you don't have an idea, you know, I mean, I'm all for find the moments in your show that aren't working and write to them or cut them out. One of the two.
Yeah.
So I will give you another exercise, which is the somewhat advanced and rigorous exercise that I think is worth doing to an act once every 5 years.
Mm.
More, you know, once a month, you would be an insane person to do this, but it's totally worth doing, which is record the show, the actual way it was performed at the kind of venues you play all the time. Not the worst one, not the best one.
Not the best, yeah.
Record the show and then write it out, word for word, what it is. Back in the day, we did this by typing it in ourselves. Now you can get that done by transcription services for cheap.
Yep, by the time you get back to the hotel, Rev could do it for you.
Exactly. So you have an actual transcript, not of what you thought you said or what the joke is written on. This is the actual script we performed. Great.
Wow.
Now, go through, it's typed in, go through and where the laughs are, just put a carriage return. You know, just put, you know, so it's written out, take away all of the lines, but, you know, remove all the carriage returns between lines. So all you have is just the words straight down the page.
Gotcha.
Not alternating with who said what. Just these are all the words in one paragraph.
Beautiful, right.
Go in where people are laughing and put in a carriage return. If they laugh more, put in two. If they're laughing and clapping, put in three. If they're laughing, clapping, and you have to wait, put in four. Just, you know, about the length of the laugh is carriage returns. Now go back and look at the script. Any place where you've got a chunk of words, that's where you suck.
Wow.
The white space is what's good. You look at this, you look through this document and you just go, this is, you know, and you could also do it instead of the number of words, you could do it by the time. But it's just a way to do that sort of laughs per minute thing.
I love
it. And you'll see. And you'll look at it, and those sections will almost always be places where you're going, okay, we need a volunteer. Who wants to help? Anybody? It could be anybody. It won't be embarrassing. You want to help? Come on, give them a big round of applause. Come on up here. It's all those functional things where you're saying all these words and not getting a single laugh.
Gotcha.
And they stand out on the page as these gray, blocky, crappy parts of your show.
Beautiful.
So now you know, you go, that's what I should be changing. That's what I should be writing for. I should just do something to it. Sometimes the solution is just cut it out. Is there a way to just, you know, like in that example I gave where it's getting a volunteer, is there a way you can just walk out into the audience and just grab someone and say, I need a volunteer. Thank you.
Boom. I need not even a full line.
Thank you. Five words, and you'll probably get a laugh from grabbing them because of crossing that boundary.
Right. Well,
the aggressiveness of it.
That's your math background right there. I think you can track around to the beginning.
Exactly. And if you're not the kind of character who would go out and grab them by the shirt and drag them up, go out and say, I need a volunteer. Could be anybody. And then just fall on somebody's feet and start crying.
Yeah, exactly. So
there are any number of ways of doing it, but those are the places to write for, to replace, to remove.
Love it. Yeah.
And if not that, even if you don't do that, even if you don't do your homework, just next show, don't say any of those words. Just do something different.
Do something.
Put yourself in the situation. It's not going to be worse, because I can tell you that part of your show, that chunky part there, sucks.
Yeah, guaranteed. Yeah, it can't be worse. Hey, man, you got like 3 minutes till your next call.
Appreciate
your time, your expertise. Is there anywhere you've written online that I could put a link for people
to? Yes.
You can email to me.
I'll email it to on my website, but I've got a whole book. Basically, I wrote a bunch of columns. And it's all free. It's, you know, it's like 65,000 words now of stuff.
Oh my gosh. Wonderful. Thank you.
It's published on the IGA website in a monthly column I wrote for a few years called Be Funnier with Scotty Meltzer. There's one of them was written with your old partner.
Oh, nice. Good.
Who shall not be named on his, on the Dan Holzman framework method.
Right.
Framework is what I think he called it. Yeah. So yeah. And I'll send you a link to all of them.
I love it, man. Hey, thank you so much.
Bye, kids.
Bye, everyone.